for a long time in my own life, I have been intrigued with people who really do change the world, people whom I would describe as transformational. For a long time, I've been intrigued with what makes them who they are. Why are they not routine Christians? And there are plenty of these out here. I have a suspicion that here at COS, there are not a few of these kinds of people. Whenever I read or meet a person like this, a person, a Christian of passion, I have always found that they have had the same experiences. Somewhere, when you unpack their life, they have had what I call a second conversion. I'm not talking about a conversion to Christ here. I'm talking about some other conversion which transforms their thinking utterly. They have made some encounter, perhaps, with poverty. It could be with AIDS. It could be with immigration. It could be with veteran issues. I read recently about a Christian woman who found out that there was all of this, there was a difficulty with breastfeeding infants in Africa, and she decided that's just wrong, and so she's got a whole organization going, freezing American breast milk. Well, it could be anything, trust me. Sometimes it's political issues like Afghanistan, it's hard to say. Once I had a student named Lisa who decided to do a six-month internship in Congo, and I remember when she came back from her Central African experience, she said to me, "This has been a turning point." And I said, "Well, why? What happened to you there?" She said, "I was working at an orphanage, and then what arrived was a children's army." And she said to me, "It is wrong to weaponize 12-year-olds. She couldn't believe what she was seeing. And today, she has devoted herself to that work in Congo. These people meet somebody. They go someplace, they read something, they see a film. I'm not sure what it is, but they know it's been a game changer for them. There has been a paradigm shift in their life. They've experienced a conversion. They've looked behind the curtain, and they know that there is no going back. They have had what I call an encounter. It's an encounter that we might envy. And that encounter reorganizes everything that they are. There are a couple interesting characters, I think, who have modeled this kind of thing. Some are Christians, some are not Christians. One is a guy named Paul David Hewson. Those of you who are under 30 would need to be reminded that's Bono. For those of you under 30, he's a musician. He writes music for U2. U2 is a band. Yeah, okay. Anyway, in 1979, Bono ran into Amnesty International. Now, remember that he was just this Irish rock guy who was doing bars, clubs, and concerts in Ireland. And then he went on this trip to do music in Africa. And there he meets Amnesty. It's a game changer for him. Because for the first time, he had seen the devastation that AIDS does to Africa. And so what happens then is that he joins the One Campaign. And for 35 years, he has had an unflinching commitment to the One Campaign. Whenever he does a concert, he can't help himself. He will tell you to write a check to the campaign. So in other words, what happened in Bono's life was that there was a game changer. In fact, what's happening now, I think, is there is emerging inside of his own life a way to interpret how you change the world, and a faith is now being reborn in his own world. The other person that I think is fascinating in this regard is Melinda Gates. Now, you know, of course, you know Bill and Melinda Gates, Microsoft and all that. Bill is, of course, your ultimate geeky guy who likes to talk about technology. Have you ever seen them interviewed together? It's really funny. He's just, right. Talk about geek, there he is. But Melinda, I think, is the interesting one. I'm confident that if you unpacked Melinda's story, you would find inside of her story some kind of a conversion. And in fact, she is the catalyst who led to the development of the Gates Foundation. You know, it started with $2 billion they gave away for charitable work, and then they phoned up their friend Warren Buffett and said, "Do you have some money to give us?" He had $30 billion laying around. So therefore, they put it all together, and they have this enormous foundation. Today, they have invested $41 billion that they work, and they have given about $40 billion away in their history so far. Is that crazy or what? Now, Melinda hates interviews. And in fact, I have only found one in-depth private interview that she has ever done. CBS did it on 60 Minutes about 5 or 6 years ago. And it's the only one on record where she talks about why she started this whole thing. And you know where it came from? It came from India. And when she was in India, she discovered that polio was rampant in India. And it blew her mind. And she decided, we are going to kill polio in South Central Asia. And you can see these amazing videos of how rewarding it is for her to hold an Indian baby and give this baby 2 or 3 drops. Remember that those drops that we would get on our tongues when we were little? We don't remember this. And that child will be guaranteed not to have polio for the rest of their life. Melinda Gates says, it rocked my world. The other guy that I think about in this regard is a guy named Gary Haugen. He's one of my heroes. Gary Haugen, in the 1980s, he was working for Desmond Tutu because he'd always been a guy passionate about justice issues. And so therefore, in South Africa, he wanted to work during the apartheid era for reconciliation and political reform. In the 1990s, Gary Haugen worked for the Department of Justice in Washington. He's a lawyer from the University of Chicago, and by now he's a specialist in human rights and abuses and everything. But in 1997, he forms International Justice Mission. What is this thing? He decides what he has to do is multiply himself so that around the world we can begin making changes in the way people treat other people. Today, he has 250 lawyers working for him on 5 continents. I have had multiple students of mine go on internships to work at one of his 17 field offices around the world. And Gary Haugen is a passionate Christian. That's what drives his engine. But you don't simply have to be one of these celebrity types like Bono or Melinda Gates or Gary Haugen. You can just be a regular sort of person as well. And those stories abound likewise. Let me tell you one of mine from a student that I knew a long time ago. Her name is Shane Moore. Shane is a Wheaton College graduate. She calls herself a soccer mom and says it nicely. She has 3 kids, and she says her life basically orbits around Old Navy and Target. Anyway, when I was at Wheaton College in 2002, Bono and Ashley Judd were both coming to do a concert, and we knew the place was going to be packed. We really did. And so therefore, every student on campus got 1 ticket to go hear Bono. I got a ticket because I just talked a freshman out of it. That's why freshmen exist, you know? I just said, Bono, this guy's so boring and he's so old. You don't want to go here, Bono. This dude goes, yeah, you're probably right. And I said, I'll take it. So there, I got it. Good. Anyway, so Shane Moore, she's probably in her 30s, she goes to the concert and she scalps 3 tickets. She puts $80 in her pocket and she looks for a freshman. Fantastic. She's dragging her 1-year-old and her 4-year-old with her. And she says she listened to Bono. The concert was awesome. But then Bono and Ashley Judd began talking about the One campaign, and she began talking about Africa. And she says it was a game changer. It knocked, she says, quote, the suburban wind right out of me. She joined the One campaign. She has spoken all around the place for this kind of thing. She has published a book called Global Soccer Mom, Changing the World is Easier Than You Think. She is really fantastic. And you would think to yourself, what happened to her? She will tell you she was at a Bono concert and everything changed from that point forward in her life. Recently, I think I have had a glimpse of somebody who is 18 years old who has this very same, what I call, fire in her belly. You remember in February, there was a shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School. There were 17 fatalities, Parkland, Florida. And you might remember that what emerged out of that entire catastrophe were 5 high school seniors who made the cover of Time magazine. And one of them, Emma Gonzalez, you remember her, she has the buzzed haircut and the ripped jeans, she's amazing. All 5 of these became organizers and spokespersons for what they wanted to do. Hashtag never again. That's what they were about. She spoke 3 days after the shooting, alone, it was incredible, on February 17th, for 11 minutes. 11 minutes that will probably be shown to high school students in the future. We need to be the change that we need to see is a quotable phrase coming from Emma Gonzalez at 18. She says, "They will read about us students at Sherman Douglas in textbooks someday if we are lucky." So what I find is that with all of these people, there is something that begins the course of their lives. There is, first of all, an undeniable experience. These game changers, these transformational people, they have an encounter. There is a moment. They can point to that moment and they won't ignore it. That's the first thing that happens to every one of them, an undeniable experience. But with all of these people, there are three other things that follow rapidly right after they have that experience. First of all, they do what I call an immediate gut check. In other words, after they've had this experience, they do an assessment of who they are, and they ask themselves, is this the life I've really wanted to live? Or do I want to stir everything up and make a change? And then third thing that happens, there is what I call an enviable focus. You don't get in these people's way. They are focused like a laser. They have a singular commitment, and they decide that they are going to change whatever this thing is they don't like. And then fourthly, finally, there is what I think of as an infectious enthusiasm. They inspire other people. They know that their instinct is to go fast, but they want to go far. And so therefore, they bring other people with them, and most of them build some kind of an organization. They have a vision for doing impossible things, and they know that this great thing will take a great organization. Well, so there it is. There are transformational people. There are four things that are characteristic of them wherever you find them, and when you begin to chart their own lives and you unpack a Melinda Gates or you unpack a Shane, you find out that they have these experiences, this self-analysis, they have this incredible focus, and they are so enthusiastic about how they're going to change things. I think that we have one of those transformational people inside the New Testament. I think it is the woman of Samaria. If you look back at the story that we read this morning, you can see in verse 7, that here we have this Samaritan woman who happens to encounter Jesus at a well. And then if you look at the end of the story, you can see in verse 28, she is someone who sprints from Jacob's well. She goes back to her Samaritan village. Imagine the risk involved for her with her reputation going back to her own home village saying, "I met a man out at the well." The jokes would begin immediately. Notice verse 39. Many of the Samaritans from the town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. So here we have a woman who goes from 0 to 100 miles an hour. See, a woman who has actually moved through all of these stages, and that's really fascinating. There is a template found inside of her that is lived out again and again, even in our generation. So the first thing I know about her is that she has this chance encounter. She comes, of course, to this well. It's noon, and you would know probably from past teaching that no one gathers water at noon in the Middle East. There are two times you gather water in the Middle East when you go to a well. First of all, you do it in the early morning at sunrise, and you do it at sunset. It's hot there, and no one wants to do this. And besides, women always have the task. Why not? It is hard work. It's heavy. Water is heavy. Women have always done it. So the well becomes a place of a woman's domain. We're going to use that in a moment. When she gets to the well, she finds that there's a man sitting there. He's alone because the disciples have gone, and he becomes an obstacle. Right away, if you were a Jewish reader 2,000 years ago, looking at this story, you'd think, oh, this is awkward, terribly awkward. A man and a woman. There are strong gender boundaries inside of this culture. A man and a woman meeting in a well, you don't do that kind of thing. She should have turned around and gone away. He is a Jew. She's a Samaritan. The rift between these two cultures was enormous. He is righteous. She is unrighteous by reputation. And therefore, how is it that they are going to have anything to talk about? So this man provokes her. Give me something to drink. Now, here is something you might not know about this story, which is fascinating. Because women controlled wells in the ancient world, wells became a kind of trope inside of Jewish literature for romance. So therefore, here's a tip. If you happen to be lost in the Middle East in the desert, just find a well, lay down, go to sleep, and you'll find someone to rescue you. It will be a group of women. That's what Moses did. He's no fool. He's in Sinai wandering around. He finds a well. He lays down, goes to sleep. He wakes up. He meets Zipporah, and they get married. Perfect arrangement for any college student. This story has the same cultural force as this scene in our modern day. A woman is on a business trip. She is sitting at the bar at the hotel. She's sitting at the bar there having dinner. And a man walks up and says, "Can I buy you a drink?" He is not thinking about her hydration. We look at that entire scene in a movie or in real life, we say to ourselves, "Oh, I know what that is. He's hitting on her. We get it." This scene of a well and a woman and a man alone is a romance picture, is what you have inside of the ancient world. And so therefore, when they have this conversation, you're wondering, where is this thing going to go if you had been a Jewish reader? So look at verse 10. Jesus says, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would give you living water." Now, what Jesus is doing here is he's laying two questions in front of this woman. He is controlling the direction their relationship is going to go. First of all, can you figure out who I am? And secondly, are you able to determine how I could supply you with living water? Now, at that moment, when this woman is having this encounter, whenever we have one of these encounters, we are at a crossroads. You have to choose. Are you going to deflect your interests and turn away, or are you going to step into what you have just encountered? And so for this woman has the very same temptation. Is she going to deflect Jesus? Is she going to dodge what it is he is asking? Or will she move forward into it? And the obstacle that is in front of her is this phrase, living water. Let me do a little detour here again. When Jesus offers her living water, it is not fresher water. This is not LaCroix. This is not cool water, better water. Living water is a code inside of Judaism. Living water is water which has come directly from the hand of God, and therefore is the only water that can be used for ritual purification. So therefore, if you're in a well and the water is just standing at the bottom and you lift it out, when it's moved by human hand, it becomes dead water. If, on the other hand, it has just rained and there's a pool over here, or there is a lake that has never been moved by human hand, that is living water. And therefore, you can go into it and be made clean. When Jesus says to her, "I can supply you with living water," he is talking about cleansing her. He is not talking about satiating her thirst. Here is a woman who has so lived on the margin of her Samaritan society, she has not been near a purification event in years. They would never permit that kind of thing. So therefore, Jesus is saying, "I am someone who can bring you purity." Now, there's an issue inside of her life. What is the issue in her life? The issue is her history with men. And here we have to be incredibly clear. This is a woman who has had multiple husbands. And we have said in the church far too many times, this is a woman who has divorced 5 men, but on the contrary, in her culture, she doesn't have the capacity to divorce. This is a woman who has been divorced. And this is a woman who now lives with another man, and I am sure she has given up on marriage. She has decided that men and marriage will never serve you rightly. But now, for the first time, she has met a man who will treat her with dignity and respect. Do you see how the romance and well and woman metaphor is all working together here? So here, she decides to move ahead with Jesus. So she wants to find the Messiah, she says, and she wants to meet him, and she wants to become passionate about a new kind of life. And so what do we have? Finally, we have with this woman someone who does at last ask for the water. Look at verse 15. "Sir, give me this water so I won't be thirsty and you have to keep coming here to this well." She wants this water because she wants a new way to think about her life. So inside this woman's life hides the secret, I think, of being a transformational person. She has had an undeniable experience with Jesus. She meets him, and it changes everything about her. She does an immediate gut check. She has to look inside of her life and ask herself, what is it that has to be rearranged in my heart if I am going to move forward? And then she has this enviable focus that I talked about. It is no accident inside of the story that she leaves everything behind. In fact, she leaves her water jar behind and sprints to the Samaritan village. John, who loves symbols and metaphors, he knows that the instrument of her original quest must now be abandoned. And then lastly, fourthly, there is this infectious enthusiasm. She runs to the village and she becomes a recruiter for Jesus. An encounter, a self-assessment, an amazing focus, infectious enthusiasm. This is a woman who is a transformed person. This is a woman who has stepped into an encounter she never, ever saw coming. This is a woman that would change her entire city. So if we wanted to, the question is, can we take this kinds of lists and give it a you might say, a theological or a spiritual reframing? I think we can. Those of us who have been Christians for a very long time, we look back at that transformational experience we had when we first gave birth to our Christian walk. But here what we know is that there are people who go through these other experiences, these supplemental experiences where they've encountered something and that changes everything for them. So it's almost like this. There is not encounter, but there is revelation. Something is revealed to us. There is confession where we do an assessment of our own lives. There is devotion and action where we begin to laser-like focus on the thing that needs to be done. And then there is a vision for greater things. This is Shane Moore. This is Shane Moore, whose life is organized around it. This is Gary Haugen. This is the profile of a sequence of experiences that every man and woman have had if they're going to change the world. I was in California a few years back, and I was speaking at a church, and after I was finished, there was this lady who came up to me, and I was talking about something kind of like this, and I'll never forget, I was standing just about right here, and she walks up to me, and she says, "I get this." You know when a woman comes up to you, and she's probably 78 years old, and she goes, "I get this." You're like, "Whoa, I'm going to listen to this." So she tells me this story. It's a crazy story. She, her name is Rachel, and Joan go on the trip of a lifetime to Uganda. And when they go to Uganda, they want to not only see Africa, but they also want to see something about what the church is doing. And they learn that these little girls under the age of 12, when not dressed appropriately, and I'm saying this discreetly, they are subject to remarkable abuse. And there again, I've used code language. So therefore, they say to themselves, you just have to dress them right. In other words, if they just wear something that drops from their shoulders down to their knees, everything changes for them. And all of the aid workers they were with said, absolutely, everything changes for them. So they come back home, and it so happens that both of these women were into sewing. And they say to themselves, we're going to fix this in Uganda. Ain't going to happen anymore. So they start this thing called Dress a Girl Around the World. And I'm talking to the lady who's actually started this thing. If you go on the web and just go to dressthegirlaroundtheworld.com, you'll find their website. So what they do is they say, we're going to go to Walmart, we're going to buy pillowcases, we're going to cut a hole in the top, and we're going to sew this thing into an immediate dress, and we're going to send them to Uganda. They do this, and they tell their friends. They have had an encounter in Uganda. They come back, and they say to themselves, we don't live with this kind of risk. We are going to do something different. They call together all these women who know how to sew, and they start sewing dresses for Uganda. What in the world? Let me flash forward. Rather than 220 women, which finally ended up in their groups, can you imagine 220 women hauling in sewing machines in this room, and they're all churning out dresses? Can you imagine that? To date, Rachel and Joan's organization have sent 450,000 dresses to 82 countries around the world. Is that amazing? There are organizations, if you live in Michigan and you want to find out if you can join one of these circles, go online and they will tell you. There's a woman named Erin who organizes all of Michigan. They no longer use pillowcases though, but they use instead all kinds of fabrics. The point is that here you have transformational people who then launch their lives differently after they've had what I think of as this second conversion. That is Shane Moore. That is Gary Haugen. That is these people and these young people inside of Florida. This is the Samaritan woman. And this is the kind of person that I want to be. I hope it's the kind of person that you want to be, willing to change the world, willing to take a risk. And when God gives you an encounter that rearranges everything in your thinking, you lean into it. You don't step away from it. Because if you do, the course of your entire life will be different. Amen. Let's pray, shall we? Lord God, we do ask that you would help us to see not only in the Samaritan woman's life the story of a converted woman. Help us to see a transformed woman and in this find our own transformation. Lord, we pray that you would open a door for each of us. Give us an encounter, and then give us the courage to hold on to what we see and forever be changed. And all of God's people said,